This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Dixon Mounds Museum in Lewiston is set to close next week after decades of first displaying and then studying Native American remains. Budget cuts are dooming the facility. You'll meet the man who's been there since before the museum opened.
When we look in these places and we excavate, we don't see dead. We don't see death and dying. We see life.
Judy Valente introduces you to Alan Harn during another episode of Unknown Illinois. The next BN by the Numbers event is tomorrow. You'll get a preview of the quarterly economic report from the EDC's Amy Ingalls. And during Talkin' Blues, world-renowned harmonica player Bob Corator talks about his native Chicago area roots. All of that and the GLT News update on the way. It's September 23rd, 2015. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT. With additional support from the Jack Batal Real Estate Group, more information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. The clock is running down on the days left to visit one of the foremost Native American archaeological sites in the United States. Next Wednesday, the Dixon Mounds Museum in Lewiston is set to close. The museum is a casualty of state budget cuts. It's not clear what Governor Rauner's delay on state layoffs will play into the closure of the museum. In another of our series, Unknown Illinois, WGLT's Judy Valente visits the Dixon Mounds with an archaeologist who spent the past 53 years studying these sites for clues into the lives of Illinois' earliest residents.
Growing up along the Illinois River, Alan Harn often walked his family farm searching for Indian arrowheads and artifacts. Harn's boyhood hobby turned into a lifelong passion the day he heard a talk given by Dr. Don Dixon. Dixon was a local chiropractor and self-taught archaeologist who had excavated an ancient Native American burial site not far from Harn's home and preserved it for public viewing.
It was the sincerity that he spoke about the people who were buried here and their importance and the things and experiences that we still share with them through time that had a profound effect on my life. And it was one of the reasons with his influence that I went into the study of man.
Few know more about the Illinois Valley's early Native American inhabitants than Harn. He started as a 21-year-old in 1962, working alongside Dixon. Harn has explored all 10 Dixon Mounds and mapped 1,104 sets of their human remains.
When we look in these places and we excavate, we don't see dead. We don't see death and dying. We see life.
Now, at age 74, Harn still approaches his work at the museum with wonder.
Every day I walk through that door and I step into an ineffable world. And you realize daily how Howard Carter must have felt in 1922 when he broke in to Tutankhamun's tomb and someone asked him, "What do you see?" And he said, "There are wondrous things. This building is filled with wondrous things and wondrous stories."
At the center, which is here and everywhere, is the Great Spirit of the universe.
The current day museum, set to close September 30th, was built over one of the main burial mounds. Until 1992, visitors could still see some of the actual skeletal remains exactly as they had been positioned in their graves some 700 to 900 years before. Public displays of Native American remains are now widely discouraged. At the Dixon Museum, extensive exhibitions now tell their story.
This is one of the few places that you can really come and get an appreciation of the wonderful cultural heritage that's left here by the American Indian. The important thing about this is that the people lived and stayed in the same area and didn't move. So we have an unbroken record through time.
With the museum closing, it seemed like a good time to talk with Harn about the most surprising facts he's learned over 5 decades of exploration. The first groups in the area were woodland people who survived by hunting, gathering, and rudimentary gardening. As their original community grew into a kind of urban farming village, problems surfaced.
At that point, you begin to see your first evidences of violence. It wasn't until they developed a concept of land ownership and control.
Evidence of violence is stamped onto the remains.
Two of them had arrows still stuck in the bodies that showed no healing. Two of them were buried together. Their heads were missing. They were killed away from the protection of the village. Those two bodies weren't found for probably weeks, and by that time they'd been scavenged by carnivores. The flesh had disappeared, and the bones were sun-bleached.
Why would their heads be missing?
They take them for trophies.
Also, as more outsiders arrived, a new social structure emerged.
The newcomers brought with them a new idea of hierarchy, tiered hierarchy. And so there were people here after 1100 with power over life and death.
Harn says leaders emerged who were believed to have mystical, almost divine qualities. Once again, the human remains tell a story.
We find, in fact, in the Dixon excavation, 2 burial pits that contain human sacrifices. But when people were sacrificed, they clamored to come forward to be sacrificed, to go with that important person and be a part of the next life.
But there is also much evidence of tenderness and respect for the dead.
There are infants here buried with equipment. They're 2 or 3 months old. They could never have used that pipe that was buried with them or the little food bowl that way. But these people had a belief in the afterlife, much as we have a belief in the afterlife today.
In fact, violent deaths among the Indians were relatively few. Disease and malnutrition took a far greater toll. What has it taught you about human nature or human beings?
Probably the main thing I've learned is man hasn't changed through time. We are mirror images of all of the people who have come before. We have the same fears, the same hopes, the same needs, the same prejudices. And it's mirrored here, clear back to the beginning of time.
In his office, Harn keeps a photograph of Don Dixon holding one of his favorite artifacts from the excavation, a carefully crafted bowl with a duck head on it, found packed away in a child's burial site. Like Dixon, Harn has been more interested in what these artifacts show about the daily life and psychology of early Native Americans. Here's Dixon speaking in a 1969 interview about his goal in excavating the mounds.
The fact is, it's the first time, I believe, anyone ever took the time to uncover a prehistoric man and leave the material in its original position.
Harn says even when the museum closes its doors to the public, its artifacts and exhibits locked inside, his archaeological research will go on.
I have moved all of my library. I have duplicated all of my personal scientific records I've made on my own time. I've transferred all of those to my home over here at my farm. And the day that this closes, my research will continue.
Harn plans to continue his research on what is known as the Larson site. It was an Indian settlement of about 100 houses dating from the 1200s, located on a bluff a mile west of the Dixon Mounds. The houses all burned, but many everyday items were found buried there underneath what is now a modern-day cemetery.
The great thing about that site is when the village burned, no one was able to get back in and save anything. So all of the artifacts are lying on the house floors in the positions they were being used in life. It essentially fossilized a segment of the community where you could view it at one time in its history when that day stopped and time stood still, much like Pompeii.
It will be a return in time of sorts for Harn as well, who first worked on the Larsen site in 1964. He says an archaeologist's work is never really done. That's because the work, according to Harn, is not a job, it's a passion. I'm Judy Valente, WGLT News.
According to Harn, the Dixon Mounds have inspired more than 90 scientific studies, including books, dissertations, and master's theses. Don Dixon was one of the first archaeologists to emphasize the study of Native American daily life over the collection of their artifacts. Because of his pioneering excavations, Dixon Mounds is often referred to as the birthplace of American archaeology. Dixon Mounds' closure is set for next week. It is unclear if that will be delayed now, but Governor Downers delaying some state worker layoffs.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, committed to helping you find the right match. Buying or selling your home can be easy. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. Coming up, a major conference on preventing child sex abuse convenes in the Twin Cities. Jim Brown talks to one of the keynote speakers. That's coming up during Sound Ideas. Every quarter, the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council presents its BN by the Numbers luncheon, spotlighting a segment of the Central Illinois economy. This quarter's event, over the noon hour tomorrow in Normal, centers on BN Advantage, the coordinated business marketing plan for Bloomington Normal and McLean County. And with us right now is Amy Ingalls. She's with the EDC, and she's going to be presenting BN by the Numbers. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
At tomorrow's event, you'll be examining economic factors for the third quarter, which doesn't actually end for another week, but trends are well in place. Let's look at unemployment first of all. New net jobs increased by 4% last quarter. What types of jobs were added, and which sectors were still struggling?
Right. You know, the labor market is looking very strong right now. And, you know, we did add some net new jobs, and we did this for the first time in several years. So, we're kind of like the little engine that could along those lines. So, you know, we're kind of coming along slowly. We added some new jobs in leisure and hospitality. And I think, you know, in this area, you know, we're making a deliberate attempt in that particular area at the local level. We're seeing that come to fruition. Transportation, warehousing, and utilities, we've seen an increase in that industry sector. Manufacturing, a slight increase, which is not along the national norm. So we'll see if that changes over the next few quarters. Mining and construction, that is decreased, and that is just not going to change. We're going to see a consistent decrease in that sector.
And none of this, of course, reflects any changes brought on by Mitsubishi, possibly even the community, nothing like that. This is a snapshot of what happened in the last quarter.
Correct.
The jobless rate in July was up about a point compared to April. Are there typically more people looking for work in the summer compared to the springtime?
I don't think that I would characterize it like that necessarily, but there are seasonal, you know, issues.
No, and maybe 1% isn't that much really to get excited about here.
No.
When you look at the long-term job picture over the past 5 years, which sectors of the economy performed better and which ones lagged behind over that that big chunk of time?
Well, we stayed real even in education and health, professional services, financial activities. So we've remained real steady there. That's really positive. Where we're really even there, we're really happy to see that. So we're staying steady.
What were the problem areas?
Those problem areas, I mean, government seems to be a problem area where they've always traditionally had very high peaks, very low peaks. When you have a community where you have very large employers in the government sector, you really want to keep a close eye on that. I mean, so we're kind of seeing a long-term trend there with a decrease in that industry, so we want to keep a close eye on that.
In housing, the one thing that sticks out is July new home sales were way down this year compared to last year. There were 21 last year and just 13 in July this year. But through the year, the numbers were actually up due to one big month that was reported in March. What was going on during March? The numbers were just huge this year.
Yeah, that chart, and I know our, you know, your listeners don't have the luxury of seeing the charts. Hopefully, you know, if we have some attendees at the event, they'll be able to see these in person. You know, this is, you know, year-to-date information, so, you know, this gives you a snapshot of what's happening, you know, volume-wise over, you know, every month throughout the year. So, you know, in March is really when they're ramping up and starting with construction and starting with sales, and people are out looking. So you're going to see a little bit more activity. And we did have quite a cold area there.
The weather has a lot to do with it when you're talking about getting outside, starting to construct homes, that sort of thing.
And in 15, though, is when you saw a much higher increase this year, is the chart showing.
Yeah, I mean, this March was a lot better than last March, probably because in March of 14, it was still bitterly cold throughout much of that time, whereas this year it wasn't quite as bad.
Quite as cold, right.
Now, you talk about big swings. Boy, in retail, particularly in the city of Bloomington, there was one really big swing. Most of the sectors, it seems like, for retail sales in Bloomington were fairly consistent, a little bit up here, a little bit down there, except for furniture and household sales were up more than 136%. What is happening here?
Right. That one really stands out there, doesn't it? That we attribute to, and we call these super sectors, these categories. And this super sector happens to be furniture, household items. And under these super sectors are smaller categories of retail sales that are occurring under here. And a lot of these categories would include what would be occurring in the remodel business. And that's what's happening. So instead of a lot of new construction occurring, we're seeing a lot of remodeling activity happening.
So people are remodeling their homes, they're buying new washers and dryers, new television sets, and the furniture to sit on to watch all these
exactly.
things. Exactly. Yeah. In normal, there were some bigger swings in more areas, but the numbers didn't swing as much as 136%. But there were still a few areas that acted out a little bit differently in normal. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, exactly. And I had to break these out. Usually I'll put them on the same chart, but we broke these out. But you still, you know, it was consistent with the furniture and the household sales in Bloomington we saw the same in normal with a very large, percent growth in that retail sector in normal. So, you know, this is a comparison between quarter two of 2014 and quarter two of 2015. So a snapshot between, a year apart. A big growth, you know, it looks like a dramatic amount of growth happening.
When you're dealing with a smaller sample size, the percentages are exaggerated a little bit. Look at the actual numbers.
So the increase in this particular, these growth areas, so it's a little less dramatic, let's say, from last quarter to this quarter, 2015.
Every quarter, part of the BN by the Numbers presentation includes a survey of community businesses and employers. What were you asking last quarter, and what kinds of answers were you getting to these questions?
Same questions we ask every quarter to very local businesses. We want to get their kind of perceptions of what they foresee, since we're taking a snapshot with this other data from what's already happened. We want to understand what they're looking at going forward. And we ask them what their outlook is on the cost of doing business, if they're hiring, what they think the housing market is going to look like going forward. And they told us that they think the cost of business is going to increase a little bit, just a little bit. But they also told us that, unlike last quarter, when they were absolutely not going to hire at all, that completely changed, and they're going to hire probably more so than they have in many, many years, which makes sense since the labor market is very healthy. And that would make sense since I would attribute probably the cost of doing business to go along with hiring new folks.
Amy Ingalls is the Director of Research and Economic Data for the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council. She presents BN by the Numbers every quarter. Tomorrow's Noon Hour event centers on BN Advantage, the coordinated business marketing plan for Bloomington Normal and McLean County. Amy, thanks for coming by to share the latest numbers with us.
Thanks.
Coming up during Sound Ideas, Bloomington art exhibit explores last year's disappearance of dozens of Mexican college students. Laura Kennedy takes you there. That's ahead during Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Housing restrictions on sex abusers are counterproductive, and therapy does work. Now, that flies in the face of what many people believe, and it's an example of wrong information about abuse that a seminar hopes to dispel. WGLT's Jim Brown talks with one of the women who will be addressing those at the Improving the Odds Children event. It's coming up Friday in Uptown Normal.
Cordelia Anderson has made over 2,500 presentations on the issue of child abuse and says that many of our preconceptions could be wrong, including how victims may view their abusers. She says it is a cause she's been involved with since the 1970s and says that since then, a lot has changed.
At that time, in the 70s, we did not know as much as we know now about the effect of early trauma, early abuse and neglect, the ACEs study. It's called Adverse Childhood Experiences that well document a variety of traumas, including having an incarcerated parent, a parent with mental health issues, as well as witnessing abuse and experiencing abuse as having a major long-term health impact on people, but also for some, not all, but for some, having a link to themselves having problematic sexual behaviors as quite correlated to that trauma.
What is it about this type of abuse that makes it so hard for a victim to overcome the trauma?
I think it's very different if someone is abused and they have people who listen to them and believe them and know how to support them and how to help them cope. For many people that experience this kind of trauma, they don't have people they can turn to or don't realize they do, and or the people they turn to are not helpful and, in fact, can compound the trauma by shaming or blaming or not believing or under or over responding. Also, if children don't get the help that they need, they can sometimes be much more vulnerable to people who know how to identify vulnerable and needy kids and prey on that further. It's why we see such a link in girls between early sexual abuse and later sexual exploitation.
We've been using the term abuse a lot. What do you mean when you say abuse? Is it sexual abuse we're speaking of?
I deal mostly with sexual abuse when I was talking about adverse childhood experience. What we'll be talking about and where most of my work has been the sexual abuse area.
Are there therapies that work, therapies that could prevent some people from being repeat abusers?
Absolutely. What we hear about all the time in the news, of course, is the ones that don't work. We hear about people who get out and who reoffend. What we don't hear about, and that happens, particularly when they haven't had the kind of treatment they need and or they haven't had it until they've established a very long-term practice of problematic behaviors and other mental health concerns. But we do know a lot about treatment that works, and we certainly know the earlier we can start that, the earlier we can diagnose with skilled clinicians what all a person needs and what's all going on so that treatment is very focused on what is needed. That there's a number of studies that show quite a good outcome, contrary to what people believe. Most people believe that treating people who have sexually offended don't work, but as opposed to the studies that show it does. Again, you've got a subset of offenders that the treatment modalities aren't as effective with that we know of, and that tends to be what gets attention.
Do you think that's because we're perhaps looking at the wrong group of people when we're trying to get a snapshot?
I think very often we are, and people ignore the research. I mean, we tend to go with what we already believe instead of looking at the research. So it's kind of a lot, you just hear it over and over again that treatment doesn't work. Well, I don't know what studies people are looking at.
What about the impact of housing restrictions on those found guilty of abuse? They often result in the individual being ostracized from the community, but do they actually help the community?
There is an excellent report, if you want to look at it, called A Reasoned Approach, and looks at just some of the directions of policies and what helps and what doesn't help. But I think a lot of these policies were put in thinking that they protected the community, but indeed have worked against that. There are studies looking at effects, that whether that's the restricted housing, that's the limitation in how close you can live to a school, all of these different limitations. And what we know is that what's most effective for somebody to not reoffend, we want them to be able to be successful in a job, in establishing healthy relationships with good boundaries, in being proactively involved in their communities. The more you take away the opportunity to live anywhere, work anywhere, be involved in a spiritual community, be attached to your family, many of the people aren't at risk to reoffend. There's different levels of risk to reoffend, and all of these same things get applied to the same people as if it's all one type of motivation or type of offender.
We're talking with Cordelia Anderson, who is one of the keynote speakers at the September 25th Improving the Odds for Children gathering at the Uptown Marriott. Cordelia, what about the abuser when that person is part of the family?
An excellent question and point. A lot of times, and the majority of the times, the sexual abuse is by somebody the child knows and trusts. And what happens, again, it's one of the problems with a lot of our policy directions, because they're kind of based on the assumption of a stranger or based on the assumption that the victim doesn't want to have anything to do with the perpetrator and wants them locked up forever. There definitely are people victimized in those categories. But there's others who just say, you know, I want it to stop. I love this person. I want them in my life again. I don't want them to ever do that again to me or anyone else. But, you know, that's a whole different thing that in some cases is a barrier to people reporting, and in other cases creates other sets of problems. Other side of that is we want to make sure if somebody is back, the treatment they've had is going to help them, that the monitoring that they get is going to help them, that the rest of the family has learned how to be able to speak up if they have any concerns, such as if the person had a problem with drinking and they're not supposed to be drinking and they start drinking again. It doesn't mean for sure they will sexually offend, but that's a red flag. You want them to get the help to stop drinking.
What are people going to come away with after the September 25th event? What are they going to know that they didn't know going in?
I hope that they're going to have a very different understanding of prevention. For example, we tend to think of prevention as educating children to protect themselves or longer and tougher sentences on any and all who sexually offend. And I think they'll learn about a lot of different motivations who offend, but they'll also learn about a range of responses and needs from victims and a range of ways that we can be much more effective in ending the sexual abuse of children. And I hope people believe it is possible.
Americans tend to be paranoid about just about everything, and sex abusers would have to top the list of things parents worry about. Our fixation quite often tends to be on the most disturbing cases, like last month, the 15-year-old charged with abuse and murder of an 8-year-old girl in Santa Cruz. Are those fears standing in the way of our being able to deal with this topic in a mature manner?
Yes. Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, we tend to grab on to the most sensational of these, so we get very obsessed with, you know, a youth that does, like, this kind of act, and we tend to forget or minimize or not care as much about the sexual abuse that happens all the time that is more preventable, but we have to pay attention to it. And if we don't, we spend a lot of resources at how to do a better job after somebody's victimized, after they and the need to report, instead of saying and having any hope about what could we do to prevent that.
Cordelia Anderson says people do not want to talk about sex, let alone sexual abuse. Along with Anderson, Patty Wetterling, whose 11-year-old son was taken and was never seen again, will address attendees at the Uptown Normal event. I'm Jim Brown.
The Improving the Odds for Children conference begins Friday at the Marriott. Topics include the impact of pornography on children, increasing understanding of strategies that work and those that don't, and ways to change the odds on child abuse.
Support for GLT comes from Paradise Pet Hotel and Day Spa, whose highly trained and passionate staff has been serving Bloomington Normal for over 10 years. From pet daycare and grooming centers to boarding and adoption services, Paradise Pet is your local animal care facility. Fun, play, and stay with Paradise Pet. This is GLT.
And you're tuned to Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. It's the blues harmonica of Bob Corator. That's ahead here during Sound Ideas on GLT. The Jan Brandt Gallery in Bloomington celebrates National Hispanic Heritage Month by displaying works by Mexican-American artists. During the installation of some of those works, Laura Kennedy spoke with an artist whose prints and sculptures have been inspired by a recent series of tragic events that occurred in Mexico.
On September 26, 2014, 43 college students en route to a protest in Guerrero, Mexico, disappeared. The students were planning on protesting the government's funding programs for students. Initially thought to be strictly the work of a drug cartel, evidence surfaced of the involvement of the mayor and the police in the area. A year on, and the Jan Brandt Gallery in Bloomington is featuring the work of artist Janet Polito, which was inspired by the students' disappearance. Her installation is entitled Hashtag Yamegance, which translates to Enough, I'm Tired. The exhibition features small sculptures lining the stark white gallery walls. In addition, Polito has dozens of prints on the floor in front of a staging area where she hopes those who visit the gallery will become a part of the installation.
When they went to actually search for these 43 students, they came across this mass gravesite where they thought and they made the assumption that this was all the 43 students. But in the case that they were, you know, when they were looking through the DNA, they found out that it's actually not just the students, but of other people as well, other victims that were involved. And so I kind of wanted to bring that into interpretation into the whole show. And so really what's going to happen is that they have all these 100 prints. What I want to do is I want the viewer to kind of put themselves in the sort of situation where there were these volunteers and families who were looking for these students, and they had to really kind of dig down and try to find some remnants of these students, whether they're like article of clothing or their bodies themselves.
So the people coming to view this will be able to be in their shoes.
Exactly. And so every single print that you'll see is completely different to each other. I did this thing, I don't know if you ever heard of a pronto plate. It's a kind of litho plate. It's a very thin, it's like a polymer, actually. And so it's a kind of form of litho. It's the same way of doing like lithography where you involve gum arabic, and it's the same kind of process. But what's interesting about the pronto plate is that it allowed me to kind of vary the image. And so every image is completely different to each other. So you have 100 prints that is still relative. It's the same image, but they're all different. I did that purposely so that way when the viewer looks at it, they have like a choice to pick which one they want, so they can kind of dig through it. You know what I mean? Because they're looking for what they're looking for.
So it becomes participatory.
Exactly. And so in a way, the same feeling that these families were going through because they were searching for some, you know, for their family members. And then the participation is like, it's going to be recorded, but it's only with the permission that if you take a piece with you, you know, because it's free to take, you're giving me permission to record you. So that's how it's kind of a give and take of the performance.
What are you going to do with that recording?
I don't know as of right now. I might actually put that into a different show and have that kind of into interpretation with maybe what's happening there.
So this show could be part of a continuum.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's go back. September 26, 2014 mm-hmm. is when this all started. Can you tell me about your reaction to the news?
Well, I was really devastated. I think part of it is that, oh God, I can't believe this is happening again. You know what I mean? Because this is not an isolated incident. There's been many incidents that have occurred, you know, and accumulated throughout time where there's these people who are protesting, there's journalists who are trying to, you know, get the truth out, get the word out about what's happening in Mexico, and they get either kidnapped, killed, and whatnot, and just the worst of the worst. And so hearing about these 43 students, it was devastating. I think my emotions were just kind of getting to the brink where it's just all coming to a head and I just needed to do something.
Did you feel, as someone with Mexican heritage, almost a sense of responsibility to do something?
In a way, yes. I felt like that I needed to get the word out and I needed to let people know from our neighboring country. A lot of Americans don't really know what's happening in our neighboring country. And I think that part of it, I felt like there was like the sort of responsibility of me having to do that. But at the same time, it's just for myself, for my own sake, because it was just grabbing a hold of my own mentality, of my own, not necessarily sanity, but just my own self. I have family still in Mexico, and the fact of where this had occurred is very close to where my family is. But in recent events, you know, with social media, especially with Twitterverse, you know, and that's why I use the hashtag YaMeCansé, that has a lot to do with why I felt like now I can do something and I can say something and I can kind of spread the word and what's happening over there. And that's because, you know, people are starting to stand up for themselves and people are starting to unite, people are starting to protest and organize and bringing the word out.
Do you feel that art and how you're expressing through art, that can really, like social media, like Twitter, can you really start to make a difference?
I think so. I think art, you know, for many years have influenced people to do things. People just can't help but feel something. I feel like subtlety is very powerful. The intimacy of the pieces.
Getting under people's skin.
Exactly.
Let's take a look at the pieces, shall we?
Sure.
You're in mid-installation.
Yes.
So let's talk about, why did you decide to go with these materials? It looks like we have some stone,
yeah,
and then there's some various
paint.
Types of material. Paint? Is that paint?
No, it's just paint.
Yeah. And it's paint that's been peeled off of something,
exactly.
So you're wrapping them around the stone.
Yeah,
tell me about
yeah.
the inspiration.
Well, for a while, I've actually been playing around with paint and trying to use paint in a sort of like sculptural way. And I think it's very manipulative and in a way that like you can really like, it's very malleable. It's very flexible.
Forgive me, but I actually kind of want to grab it and feel it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually interesting because I've had really huge sculptural paintings that, you know, it kind of looks like a drape and it comes down and it's very seductive, very glossy. And people actually like approached to it and touched it. Like even though they know they're not supposed to touch artwork in a gallery, they do it, but they do that like subconsciously. They think about it and then they realize what they did and then they stop. And so I find that really interesting that they have this sort of interaction with the piece that they just gravitate towards it and they want to touch it.
What kind of rock is that?
It's stone. It's actual stone. I looked for these in Florida. So when I found them, and I felt like, again, I'm putting myself in that, you know, the performance that the viewer is going to put themselves in, is that I actually bend down and try to look for these rocks. So it's, you know, I'm actually kind of putting myself in the same situation that these families kind of put themselves to, or these volunteers.
By bending down to pick up the rocks,
yeah.
Like they were bending down to pick up the remains.
Yeah, exactly.
They're right now on these small circular stands that are screwed into the wall.
Exactly.
And so it's a very small space, and a small piece that you're dealing with, so it's going to be very precise.
Yeah, exactly. And so I just want to make sure that they kind of connect with each other and they bounce off each other aesthetically and also, you know, based on the colors as well. Like, I try to kind of match them as best as possible in a way.
What do you see as the future of this installation? Where would you like it to go from here?
I'm going to head off to Mexico City, and so part of it too is that I want to kind of put myself there for a while and really get a gist of what's happening over there, kind of interacting with the art community over there and what they're thinking, and as well as the people. You're constantly receiving news of what's been happening and stuff like that. So it could jump off to something else that's relative to these issues.
That's artist Janet Pulido. Hashtag Yamiganse is up at the Jan Brandt Gallery through October 5th. I'm Laura Kennedy.
And you can see photos from that exhibition at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. As one of the top blues harmonica players in the world, Chicago area native Bob Corritore travels the world playing the music that he learned to love as a teenager growing up in Wilmette. Now living in Arizona, Corritore also owns the Rhythm Room, a Phoenix club specializing in blues and roots music. Corritore also has a regular blues show on a Phoenix radio station and is enthusiastic a blues ambassador and historian. On this edition of GLT's Talkin' Blues, Corritore talks to John Norton about hearing the blues as a teen. He also talks about the valuable lessons he learned by visiting his favorite blues artists on Chicago's Tough West and South Sides.
You grew up in Chicago, and you've talked about how you heard blues on the radio, and it was almost like the first time you heard blues, it was sort of an aha moment for you. Would that be an accurate statement?
Absolutely. I heard Muddy Waters and the song Rolling Stone on a rock radio station. For the obvious reason, that's the song that the Rolling Stones named themselves after. But once I heard that, I heard everything that I loved about music condensed in that song. It was so perfect. It had all the raw guts and emotion. At the same time, it had a coolness and a toughness to it. From that moment on, Muddy Waters was my North Star.
Well, I wish I was a catfish. Swimming in a deep blue sea, I would have all you good-looking women fishing after me, showing up after me, showing up after me. Oh love, oh love, showing up.
Was it something that you were thinking at that time, even, man, I got to be around this music, or I've got to be a part of this music? Or?
Well, I knew that I was headed in a direction of learning more about that music, and what would follow I could have never even dreamed of. So I've been able to, you know, live out so many dreams and play with some of the artists that I listened to before I would ever even dream of meeting them. And next thing you know, I'm cutting records with some of my favorite artists. I used to listen to Jimmy Rogers' Chicago Bound record. I dream about that record going to sleep. Years later, I would do a couple tours with Jimmy Rogers. We'd become good friends. I'd take him in the studio twice. Something like that is what dreams are made of.
The most recent release now is with the great Henry Gray. It's called Sessions Volume 1. It's some of the work you've done with Henry over the years. Next, I'd like to play a song from this album. Let's just do the very first track, Let's Get High.
Henry recorded this song in the 1950s, and it came out on a couple reissues. But it was from a session where Morris Pigeot, who was a partner of Henry Gray's, he was a guitar player and singer, he shared half the songs. So it mistakenly, and for years, was credited as Morris Pigeot's song. I knew it was Henry when I heard it. I'm like, that's you, Henry, isn't it? He goes, yep. And so we recreated that song in the studio and captured a lot of the feel of the original one. Just a rowdy party tune, and you know, Henry's just having a blast with it. Willie Big Eye Smith and Bob Strozier are in the background shouting out answers to what Henry's singing. And you know, it's just kind of just one of those fun primal party blues numbers.
Let's get high. Let's get high. Oh, let's get high.
drunken night. I feel alright.
That's Henry Gray and our guest Bob Corritore here on GLT's Talk and Blues. When you were going into those clubs as a young guy, and you would hang out at Teresa's, that legendary club where Junior Wells used to hold court, could you talk about what it was like to be in that scene, probably, what, the 1970s in Chicago?
Yeah, you know, when I was in high school, you could see some of the blues around there being underage. I mean, Blind Jim Brewer played at a pizza place not too far away from my house. Muddy Waters actually played in my high school gymnasium. We got to see Otis Rush at a nearby college in my community. There was the Hound Dog Taylor. There was a live recording session that actually became part of an album that I was at. That was at Northwestern University. You could go to Maxwell Street and see Big Walter Horton. There's things that were pretty unbelievable. And you could also go to some of the concerts. You go to a rock concert and they'd have Big Walter Horton and Carrie Bell opening up for John Mayall. And you go, no kidding. So these were some things that were very powerful, and they were all around. I remember my first impression of all that, going into a club and going, you know, this was far away from home for me. I lived in the safe suburb of Wilmette, Illinois, and all of a sudden I'm on the west side, and there's people hanging out on the street corners with their half pints, and it's a different economic class of people. The people were, there's, you know, a lot of poverty in some of the areas. But, I'd walk into this club, the 1815 Club, see the Howlin' Wolf, and there's a gravel parking lot that probably had equal parts gravel and broken glass. But as soon as I came in, I found an amazing kindness and acceptance among that particular community. I mean, people are like, hey, how you doing? Let me buy you a beer. You go up and you meet Hubert Sumlin, meet the Howlin' Wolf, hang out with the band. Everybody was just so kind and welcoming. And I go, you know, this isn't how I might have pictured it in the tough west side of Chicago. Because there's just, you know, people are people. Everybody has a basic kindness and a great human spirit. An amazing lesson that I learned, and that was the cool thing about the blues, because it didn't matter if it was Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf or Hubert Sumlin, they weren't on a pedestal. They were real people, and they were people that had, you know, an air of leadership and dignity about them, but at the same time, they're real people, and they were happy to greet you, and some would get to know me by my first name and become friends, and it was really a fantastic thing to interact with the true blues guys. You know, I became friends with Lewis Myers, Little Walter's old guitar player. He would share all these stories. At first, I thought I was just that pesky little kid that was asking too many questions, but after years of that, I realized I had developed a really wonderful friendship with the man, and I'm so proud of that.
Hmm. 1815 West Roosevelt from the album Harmonica Blues by our guest Bob Corritore. He's playing harmonica and his friend and one-time Howlin' Wolf sideman Eddie Shaw on saxophone. You're listening to GLT's Talkin' Blues. I'm John Norton. Bob, how did you start playing harmonica?
My brother had a harmonica and actually showed me a couple of the preliminaries, how to bend a note, and it seemed to kind of come natural to me. And so I said, you're pretty good at that. Here, I'm just going to give that to you. And I was, I think, 13 when he gave that to me, and I just played every day since. And I lost a lot of friends in high school, my first years of doing that. I'd play in the back of the bus, wad up their, you know, paper and throw it at me and stuff. But it didn't deter me. I kept going. I had a wonderful group of friends that like to jam, and we would, you know, develop ourselves through all of that. Meanwhile, of course, I'm hearing the blues on the radio. I'm staying in Saturday nights to hear the blues on WNUR. I'm Northwestern University. I'm buying blues records in the stores. I'm just loving it. And here I am in high school. Back then, you know, we'd have a cassette player. I made my own mixtape of, like, Big Walter Horton and Muddy Waters and Jimmy Rogers stuff. And I'm blasting that through the hallways of my high school. And people are looking at me like, what the hell is he playing? And I'm going, this is the coolest stuff right here.
I told you a while back I wanted to get back to your Taboo album. It's one with just your name on the title, because you do so much collaboration with other artists. And this one is, it's just your name on the top. And, you know, you have some different colors and flavors on this album that I really haven't heard on some of your collaborations. Am I hearing that the way you maybe imagined it?
Yeah, Taboo is an album of harmonica instrumentals. That right there might scare you off because you think, well, do we want to hear one long harmonica solo? But I've always loved the art of an instrumental. Little Walter, of course, was so artful, and each of his instrumentals seems to say something completely different. But you know, beyond that, you look at some of the great instrumental sounds of some of the great sax players, some of the organ trios, some of the great sounds that you would hear that would be instrumental. And each of those have a groove, a mood, and a melody that is uniquely within that song. And there's a certain catchiness to each one of those. And it was that art of an instrumental that I was trying to capture in all of this. And so I took the blues, because it's really a blues record, but it takes you to some exotic places. It takes you to some things that you wouldn't expect to hear from somebody who's used to the legacy of the recordings I've played on. Because I play a lot of straight-ahead, down-home blues releases, and there's some of that on here.
Right.
But then there's songs like Taboo, which is a very exotic mood song. It was recorded in Cuba in the 1940s for the first time. It has a very bluesy side to it. But it also has this very exotic thing that goes on. And there were a number of things like that almost seemed like they could have been a soundtrack for a detective movie.
That's the blues harmonica Bob Corator, the title track to his latest solo album, Taboo. You can hear more of John Norton's entire conversation with Corator Saturday night at 7. Corator performs this Friday night at the Fluids Events Center in Champaign as part of the 2015 Blues Blast Music Awards. You want more Sound Ideas? Head to WGLT.org. You can subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. We had help today from John Norton, Judy Valente, Jim Brown, Laura Kennedy. Thanks to the EDC's Amy Ingalls for previewing BN by the Numbers. I'm Willis Kern, and I want to thank you for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal.